Was there a plan within DHS about potential reunification?
Ma'am, I was never party to any of those discussions, nor have I seen any documents relating to that.
And you, Mr. Gaudian, have you ever seen any documents such as that?
ICE always has had a plan for reunification at removal. The difference here was the quantity.
I just kind of don't buy the numbers thing, because you guys can pull up the numbers with four or five clicks, so you knew the numbers. So if there wasn't a plan in place for the kind of numbers you encountered, that lies squarely within the responsibility of the administration not adequately planning for it.
It's been more than a month since the federal government was supposed to reunify parents with their children taken from them at the U.S.-Mexico border under what the Trump administration called its zero-tolerance policy.
Well, we're on track to do it. We're working hand-in-glove with HHS, and it's certainly our intention to reunify all families that are suitable.
Today, hundreds of kids still remain in the custody of the U.S. government in shelters and foster homes across the country. I'm Cindy Rodriguez, filling in for Tanzina Vega, and we begin with that story on The Takeaway. Lee Gelernt is the deputy director of the ACLU's Immigrants' Rights Project and the lead attorney in the lawsuit against the federal government. Lee, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. So give us an update on the children still separated from their parents. How many of them remain, and why haven't they been reunited?
Right. There are, by our latest official count, 528 kids who are still separated. Children are still separated, ranging from 1 year old to 17. 343, by last count, have parents who were deported without them. So those parents are sitting in Central America without their children. We are working to try and contact these parents, explain their options, but it's a tough task. I don't want to sugarcoat it. It's a difficult task to reach all of them, to find them, and then to explain their options.
So tell me, who's looking for these parents?
Right. So we decided the ACLU could not by itself locate all these parents without significant help. So we created what we're calling a steering committee. And the central steering committee includes a worldwide law firm, two NGOs here in the United States that primarily work here in the United States, and an NGO that's based here but has significant resources on the ground in Central America, human rights, what they call human rights defenders. We have phone numbers for most of the parents. We are calling them. We have about 50 to 60 people who are making those phone calls. We haven't reached everyone so far, so I suspect we're going to have to be on the ground in Central America looking for these parents.
So let's take a step back. So these
right.
children are under the custody of the Office of Refugee Resettlement.
That's right.
And it's my understanding that these children came with some sort of information, many times a phone number, for some contact in their home country. Did the federal government have those phone numbers for a long time? And when were you able to get those phone numbers?
Right. I think you're putting your finger on an important point. You know, we believe that the federal government has had the phone numbers for these deported parents for some time, but those phone numbers were only turned over in August, and that was at the compulsion of the court. Throughout the litigation, the government has tried to wash their hands of the parents who were deported, even though their kids are in U.S. custody here. At one point, they actually took the position that the deported parents weren't even part of the lawsuit. The judge put his foot down on that and said, these deported parents are not only part of the lawsuit, but they may be the ones who are suffering the most because they're in a foreign country worrying about their child here in the United States. The government then said, well, let the ACLU find the parents. We're basically washing our hands of responsibility to find these parents. The judge again put his foot down and said, no, you created this mess. It's ultimately on your responsibility, but the ACLU has agreed to help, and we've of course said we will do anything we can, but we need the information. So we're now in a situation where we're just beginning the process of trying to find these parents. We could have been starting that process in the beginning of July and hopefully have concluded it by now. You know, it may not seem like a long time, 30 days, 40 days, but we're talking about toddlers, babies, young children without their parents. We believe there was no excuse for not turning over the phone numbers on a rolling basis.
So do you have regular contact with these NGOs? Are you getting regular reports back from them?
We are. We are in daily contact with the NGOs, everybody they find. We feed them information, what we find through phone calls. So we are working every day to find these families. And one of the difficult obstacles is that a lot of the parents don't speak English or Spanish. They speak indigenous languages. So if we do reach them, we need to have an interpreter on hand to speak one of these languages. They're often in remote villages, sometimes in areas that are dangerous. So we have trained human rights investigators going out to see them, but it's not an easy task.
So when these parents are found, how have they been reacting? Did they believe that they had lost their kids forever?
I think the feeling is pretty mixed. Some of them have been speaking to their children and had a better sense of what's going on. I think some were extremely confused. They are all to figure out what they can do. And so we're trying to advise them of their options. So it's not just contacting them, but then it's the difficult task of explaining to them what their options are. We believe there should be three options. The government has taken the position that there should only be two options. And so just to be clear about this, the government's saying the child can be sent to Central America and reunified with the parent if that's what the family wants. And we obviously ask them right away, and a lot of families are saying, send my child immediately. Some parents are making the decision that it's just heartbreaking to say, leave my child in the U.S. with a relative and let them seek asylum. I'll stay here. And the third option, which the government refuses to acknowledge when we may have to go to court, is that the parent should have the right to come here and seek asylum with their child. We believe there's a significant number of those now that we're reaching the parents, that those parents should have the right to come back and have a meaningful asylum hearing with their child. But it makes it very difficult to advise the parents when we don't know if that option is realistically going to be an option. It's going to depend on what the court says. So right now, we have to ask them whether that's something they might be interested in. But we have to be very careful not to suggest to them that coming to the United States is definitely an option at this point.
I'm talking with Lee Gallant of the ACLU about the ongoing process of reunifying children who were taken from their parents by the government at the U.S. border. And I should say also that we asked the Justice Department for comment, and they declined to because of the pending litigation. We also reached out to the Department of Health and Human Services. They're the agency that's responsible for housing these children. And they sent us this response, quote, reunification is always the ultimate goal of those entrusted with the care of unaccompanied alien children. And we are working toward that for those unaccompanied alien children currently in our custody. Lee, what do you make of that?
I think the problem with HHS's comment is that they're calling these children unaccompanied. They're not truly unaccompanied. They were rendered unaccompanied by the United States government. They came with their parents. So it's very different than a child who just comes by themselves. HHS saying these are unaccompanied children is simply wrong and distorts the issue. They're also claiming that the children are getting proper care in their facilities. That again misses the issue. The real harm to these children comes from being separated from their parents. As the medical community has said over and over, since this policy was implemented, these children are in danger of suffering irreparable harm from being separated from their parents.
So, Lee, these are the deported parents, but there's also a category of parents and kids who haven't been reunited. There's about 50 cases where the government says it's identified red flags during the background check process, like old criminal cases. Can you tell us a little bit more about those red flags?
Yeah. We have always said from the beginning of the litigation that if a parent genuinely is not fit to care for their child, they, of course, would be carved out of the lawsuit. That's just basic child welfare practice. If a parent, for example, had six convictions for child abuse, you don't want them reunited with their child. But what we've also said, and the judge agreed, is that they have to have a criminal history that's sufficiently serious that it bears on their fitness to be a parent, right? We don't take away children from parents for every crime that we would have, you know. So what we have now found out from the government is that they have roughly between 40 and 50 children they haven't reunited because they say it's a serious criminal history. But when we finally got that information, it's clear that that is not serious criminal history that would warrant taking someone's child away. We have old fraud convictions, DUI, illegal entry, possession of drugs.
Are these convictions in their homeland or convictions here in the U.S.?
They're both, but I want to emphasize they're not even only – they're not – the list doesn't include just convictions. Sometimes there's just allegations or warrants. So we have said to the government this week – for a few of them, we want more information to make an assessment. But for most of them, we feel like we have enough information that the child should be reunited. We have told the government that if the government cannot negotiate with us and actually reunite these children, I think we will be back in court on that issue because the judge has made very clear that he wants standard child welfare practices applied. We don't take a child away in this country for a fraud. It has to be something that really bears on your fitness and puts the child in danger. Things could change. We're hopeful the government will relent. But at this point, it looks like we're going to have to go to court to fight for these children as well.
Lee Gelernt is the deputy director of the ACLU's Immigrants' Rights Project. Lee, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
On Tuesday, California became the first state to completely eliminate bail for suspects awaiting trial. Governor Jerry Brown signed the bill, replacing bail with a risk assessment system into law Tuesday afternoon.
In California, the reason why it's been so abusive is our median bail is $50,000.
State Senator Bob Hertzberg is a Democrat representing the San Fernando Valley in Los Angeles.
We know from the Federal Reserve that 40% of the people across the United States have to borrow or sell something if they need to gather $400.
He co-authored the system that will replace cash bail starting in October 2019.
No longer the size of your wallet, it's the size of your flight risk or public safety risk. And there's a pretrial services assessment tool together with judicial review, and that then determines whether or not you're going to be released. And released means you may have an ankle monitor, it means you may have to call in every day or whatever. And we found in parts of California and other parts of the United States that that system works really well.
I talked with both Senator Hertzberg and his fellow co-author, Assemblyman Rob Bonta, a Democrat who represents parts of Oakland and San Leandro in the East Bay area.
I was hearing from my constituents. I was hearing from experts. I was hearing from those on the ground, all speaking with the same voice, saying our current money bail system is fundamentally broken, that it's unfair and unjust and it's unsafe, and it needs to be fixed. I was hearing stories from constituents and individuals who have lost their jobs because they were in jail and no risk to the public. They were losing their cars that were parked in time-limited areas. They were losing their homes because they couldn't pay their mortgage or their rent. In some cases, even losing their kids because they were single parents and there was no one to watch their kids while they languished in jail, even though they were no risk. And it really resonated with me that we have a money-based system where individuals are judged on the size of their wallet instead of the size of their risk, and where freedom and liberty is pay to play. And that is all wrong. And it's not fair, it's not just, and it's not safe. This policy is fairer, it's safer. It will release many more thousands of individuals safely who don't need to be locked up unnecessarily. And this is California leading the way for a fairer, more just, more safe system.
So, gentlemen, typically bail reform is something that criminal justice reform advocates would be embracing. But in this case, groups like the ACLU are opposing SB 10. They say the bill gives judges too much leeway in deciding whether to keep people in detention before their trials. And they also say that they're concerned that the tools used to decide whether someone is a public safety risk would reflect longstanding racial biases. Can you address their concerns?
Why don't you address the judges and I'll address the tools?
Sure.
Mr. Bonta.
Judges are a critical part of our constitutional government structure. They are there to do deliver justice impartially and to treat individuals as individuals. And we also understand that there are some groups, some individuals that don't always trust judges. And, you know, that's a reality. Wherever there's people, there is the potential for less than perfect delivery of certain approaches and services. But we think on balance, with the recommendations that were given, the role of judges with the meets and bounds and the restrictions and the guardrails that are put on them in this bill, that it's appropriate. And should they disagree with the judge's decision, they can appeal right away. We think that is due process at work and will lead to more justice and more fairness and more safety.
Yeah, that appeal is 3 days. And on the tools, there's a concern, and it's a legitimate concern, that they're biased. By virtue of this bill, SB 10, we now have an assessment tool process that's going to be reviewed by the Judicial Council. A panel of experts is set forth in the bill, four of them, one of whom is expert on bias, is going to approve these different high-level and medium-low deals so that you make sure that the tools work. In addition, we've baked into the bill a study that by an academic institution or a public policy institution look at bias, and Mr. Bonta and I next year are going to introduce a bill to gather to collect data. So this bill doesn't go into effect, SB 10, until October 2019, and we'll determine whether or not there's bias in the system. And guess what? Guess what? We're a legislature. Next year and the year after and the year after, we're going to be watching this like a hawk, and we're going to come back and making sure that the system works.
So, gentlemen, are you saying that annually legislators will take a look at how SB 10 is playing out?
I don't think there's a question about that. We're going to be on it. Our public safety committees will be on it. We have a reporting system. We're doing the legislation next year. Look, the big thing is the injustice. You know, people say, oh, you've traded out bail for a pretrial detention system. And our answer is we have a pretrial detention system. It's called bail. That's not fair, and it's not smart. And it's also really expensive. 63% of the people in Los Angeles County are pretrial detainees. They cost between $115 and $216 a day to keep. What's that cost government? And every time we've used these pretrial detention systems, the recidivism rate is down, the reappearance rate is up, and the fairness to the justice system is better.
So will people still be able to be released on their own recognizance?
Sure.
I mean, basically, the SB 10 drives pretrial services and judges to release individuals with the least restrictive non-monetary conditions possible. And only when an assistant district attorney brings a motion for detention does a judge consider that motion and in that instance potentially detain someone. In every other instance, they're released. It could be on their own recognizance with no conditions at all. There could be some conditions as well, as Senator Hertzberg said, where it's a text or a call from a pretrial services officer.
Right. I guess that could also be a risk, right, that somebody who would have normally been ROR'd could now be made to wear an ankle bracelet, say, or call in weekly or monthly.
That's right. That's exactly true. But one of the things that, you know, some of the critics came out early in an earlier version, and we put this in the end, that's really important to understand. We've taken out all monetary conditions. So if there's an ankle bracelet, there's no cost. If there's daily call-ins, there's no cost. There's no administrative fees. So that money is never a factor in determining somebody's liberty.
All right, gentlemen. Thanks again for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Senator Bob Hertzberg and Assemblyman Rob Bonta, both Democrats in California's state legislature.
This is Chris from South Carolina. I've had to post bail for myself, which was $800, for charges that were null processed because the police had made a mistake, and they told me that that was just money that I would never get back.
Hi, I'm from St. Louis, Missouri. We, the family members, end up posting bail and never get our money back from the offender. The line between assistance and enabling takes a while to figure out, and then you have to be strong enough to say enough is enough.
This is Rachel from Louisville, Kentucky. I had to post my husband's bond with immigration a number of years ago, and it was a horrible, horrible experience. It was a really high bond. I had to borrow money from all kinds of family members to get it up together. Then I had to drive 5 hours to Chicago to post the bond. And it took days of work to get it posted. I missed work. I had to take my child with me. It was a horrible experience.
Thanks for those calls. Share your bail story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. This is The Takeaway.
When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Cindy Rodriguez, filling in for Tanzina today. On Monday, federal judges ruled for the second time this year that North Carolina's congressional maps are unconstitutional. The ruling sets up the possibility that election officials will have to remake the state's voting processes just 2 months before a big election. Here to break down the ruling and its potential impact is Jonathan Kapler, Executive Director of the North Carolina Free Enterprise Foundation, a nonprofit, nonpartisan political research firm in North Carolina. Jonathan, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So, as I said in my intro, this is the second time this court has ruled on this case. Can you explain where this case began?
Sure. The roots of it are back in 2011 when the Republican-led General Assembly drew our congressional districts, and then immediately those districts were sued over for racial gerrymandering reasons and ultimately were found to be unconstitutional on those grounds. And so the General Assembly was then required to redraw our district lines in 2016 in kind of an unusual situation. So this is not necessarily unusual for North Carolina to have to redraw these things. And then immediately following those districts being redrawn in 2016, there was litigation begun about the districts being drawn for excessive partisan bias, and which is a totally different kind of legal question and one in which is a little bit more novel for our country, really. And so that litigation has been ongoing. And of course, there's been other court cases originating out of other states, notably in Wisconsin, that had been a little bit ahead of North Carolina in this case. And the reason that we've had this decision this week declaring our congressional districts unconstitutional for a second time is because the Supreme Court had asked an additional review be done of this case in light of their procedural rulings in other cases.
So how do voters in North Carolina feel about this gerrymandering fight?
They are confused. We have multiple streams of litigation in North Carolina ongoing at the same time, dealing with our congressional districts and our legislative districts. And so it gets very confusing for voters because you are constantly hearing the word redistricting and you're not sure what that means, where that leaves you, what district lines are or are not moving. And so, for example, in North Carolina, we actually had to redraw our legislative districts last year, and our congressional districts had to be redrawn in 2016. And so this new decision could potentially leave us with a new set of congressional districts again in 2018. Supposed to do this once every 10 years, and it seems like we're just on a treadmill and can't get off this redistricting litigation, and it's not really great for our democracy.
Right, and so not only may North Carolina have to redraw maps again, they may have to do it before the November elections, is that right?
Right. That's what the three-judge federal panel is indicating. And that's really where this is an unprecedented situation. Normally, the courts are loath to intervene in an election and kind of throw things into a chaotic situation this close to an election. We are now less than 70 days out from the November general election. But they have indicated that these are, in their belief, unusual circumstances. They're reluctant, they have said, to allow congressional races to be waged under unconstitutional constitutional district lines, which they have found unconstitutional for partisan reasons twice, and previous district lines unconstitutional for racial gerrymandering issues. And so they say North Carolina voters deserve to have constitutional districts and that they are willing to go to extraordinary measures to make that happen. And that could include things like not holding our congressional elections on the general election date, November 6th, instead maybe having primaries that day and then having a special congressional general election January 2nd, just a day before the new Congress is supposed to be seated. Mm-hmm. That is all uncertain and very confusing and could produce very unusual results in North Carolina.
Jonathan Kaplert is the executive director of the North Carolina Free Enterprise Foundation. Thanks so much, Jonathan.
It's glad to be with you.
The legal marijuana industry is popular and it's growing. 60% of Americans live in states with some form of legal cannabis use and sales. And in 2017, the industry across North America reached $92 billion. That's $92 billion for potential investors to tap into.
I think on Wall Street is pretty much the introduction to all industries, is how I'd like to say it.
Gia Moron spent more than a decade working for Goldman Sachs. Like any other industry she follows, she recognized the potential for growth in cannabis a few years ago.
So when I began seeing the coverage of the cannabis industry on CNBC, on Bloomberg, the flag went up in my head. I said, oh, I've got to start paying attention to this.
But Moron wanted to make space for a new type of leadership in this field. She joined Women Grow, an organization that cultivates female leadership in the cannabis industry, and says her mission now is to get women, and in particular women of color, to profit off this growing market.
Women Grow connects, educates, empowers, and inspires what we like to say is the next generation of cannabis leaders. I was one of those people back in 2015 that I went to my first meeting. I just started meeting people, telling them what I did. I had no idea what I wanted to do in the industry. And it was at that meeting here in New York, actually not far on Canal Street here in New York City, that I learned that what I was currently doing in PR, that I could actually do in cannabis. And, you know, everything made sense at that point. I realized I didn't have to grow. I didn't have to open a dispensary. Just do what I'm doing, but in this industry.
And so just to be clear, it's not just women that you're trying to bring into the industry. It's Black and brown women.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So the idea is all women, right? And I think that is often the misconception that, one, Women Girls Inclusive, we do have men that attend our meetings.
You do.
We do. We have a good number of men that attend our meetings. But me, as a woman of color, for me, that was also important. That I recognized that not only was I seeing white men in the forefront, I was also seeing a lot of white women in the forefront. And listen, some of my best mentors have been white males and females, but there's nothing like having a mentor or leadership that looks like yourself, that's a reflection of you.
But I'm wondering, is there a social justice component to this too? Because as we know, Black and brown people have been disproportionately affected by the criminalization of marijuana. And so now you have it being legal. And as you were saying, the people that are most involved and represented tend to be white men and women.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's interesting how our paths really help us to where we're going. So I've often worked in industries where I was often the minority, right? Prior to going to Wall Street, I worked in television. I worked in a corporate entity in a television company where there weren't very many people of color there either. Wall Street, technology, they've all had the same experiences of not having very many. But now here you have the cannabis industry. The social justice part of it is that many Black and brown people have gone to jail for what is now becoming legal across the country. So it's even more so important that we make these opportunities available to the communities that have been most impacted by this. We see white male and white women who are flourishing within the space. Meanwhile, there's so many Black and brown people who are behind bars and still, right? Or not even allowed to participate in this growing industry, and that's pun intended, right? But it's unfair, and we've got to make that right.
So I'm interested in who's showing up to these monthly meetings, you said. Tell me about the women.
Oh, my God, they're incredible. I mean, and I say that, I get goosebumps when I think about it. I'd say that the faces have changed since joining, since becoming a part of the team. But I think that that's for many reasons. I think that the media attention on the industry is really helping to draw the awareness of this. I think that the more media covers this industry, people are beginning to learn more about it. I think the narrative is changing. The mind shift is changing. And that also includes Black and brown people. Because of what has happened in our communities, oftentimes we're reluctant to even look at or consider the opportunities. So when I am meeting people who look like myself in the business world, they're now less concerned about cannabis being on their resume because will they get another job if this shows up? And the answer is there's so many people like all of us in this space. So our meetings are attracting attorneys, accountants, marketing specialists, medical. The amount of people that I meet who are nurses and doctors who are now exploring opportunities, it's phenomenal. And I love it because it's attracting everyone from young and old.
Is it attracting anyone that was involved in the industry as
in the black market?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And that's also what I feel like is interesting. I've actually met people who operated in the black market, and the growth and the expansion of this industry is even eye-opening to them. They're seeing opportunities that they were not seeing in the black market in terms of the ancillary services, right? So it's no longer just the product in a package, right? It's now the marketing behind it. When you ask who's coming to these meetings, these are people with marketing backgrounds, graphic design, PR, public relations. So they're now seeing a greater opportunity. Technology. I mean, the wealth of opportunities in this space are probably far greater than any of us would have even imagined in starting out. So those that are transitioning from black market into the legal market are also looking at how they can transition their skill set into this space.
And so what is the biggest obstacle? Is it getting investment money?
Well, I think it depends on which part of the sectors that you're interested in. If you're looking at, you know, becoming a cultivator or owning a dispensary, well, there are far more steps that are involved when you've got to get a license, right? And that requires a whole lot of capital. It also requires getting approved for one of the licenses, which is what we're seeing in New Jersey right now. The deadline for the applications for New Jersey is this week, actually, August 31st, I believe. And so you're seeing a lot of people scrambling to get their applications in. But in order for them to have gotten to that point, they also had to have millions of dollars already available to them to support this business. On the flip side, you've got the ancillary services, businesses that support, right, the core of our business. And
like, can you give me some examples?
So just as I was saying earlier, so for attorneys that are now expanding their practices to now cover the cannabis industry, looking at compliance, looking at regulation, looking at the various entities within, because it is rather complex right now. And the regulations vary from state to state. So people are now, especially on the legal side, are having to understand what those regulations are for state to state because their clients may have businesses, you know, across the country.
Gia, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Gia Moron is the Executive Vice President of Women Grow. And that's our show for today, and that's it for me on The Takeaway. Thanks for having me as I filled in for Tanzina Vega. Matt Katz is back tomorrow. Amy Walter is on Friday as usual, and Tanzina will be back on Monday. I'd love to stay in touch with you all. You can follow me on Twitter to see my reporting for New York Public Radio. I'm at CynRod, that's CYNROD. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Cindy Rodriguez, and this is The Takeaway.
A lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.